Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. The program is a program set apart. That is for true. It is set apart from the mainstream, but it is devoted to those of you who are seeking to be set apart from human institutions, who know that all of the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions are corrupt, even counterproductive. I am Yada. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is toll-free 877-300-7645. I was talking with Scott during the prelim to the show this morning, and he was mentioning that he needed a moment because he was dealing with a host that was speaking the word of Jesus, not recognizing, of course, there is no Jesus. And number two, almost every quote that those who speak the word of Jesus quote are actually Paul's, not Jesus, because Jesus didn't say anything that is consistent with their religion. Matter of fact, Jesus would be holy if he actually existed. If you just apply his name to Yahusha, his statements are wholly opposed to the religion of Christianity.
And it's not like it's something that is uncommon for me to deal with. You know, a lot of hosts preach the word of Jesus on GCN. I deal with a lot of very.
By doing that, they're quoting Paul, right?
Oh, definitely. Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I deal with very.
The word of Jesus as reported in 1 Corinthians and as reported in Galatians. But unfortunately, how many times does Paul actually quote the character known today to Christians or misknown to Christians as Jesus? How often is he actually quoted?
Never. I don't think he ever does he?
Yeah, he makes one lame attempt to take about five words that he
misquoted
said
them.
But then he misquoted him. So the answer is correct, zero, because you can't quote you can't count a misquote as being a quote. So. The answer is zero, so you can't quote Paul and be speaking the word of Jesus.
To be fair, I deal with this every day. I deal with various levels of this every day. But if you go out of your way to make my job harder because you're deciding to be stupid, I have an issue with that.
But I was told that this gentleman was the Lord's tool in fighting the sodomites.
Fighting the sodomites. That's what the whole hour was about.
Fighting the sodomites. Okay, I just want to clarify something, because I'm fairly versed in the Torah. I don't claim to be an expert on anything, make no claims of being an expert or a scholar, but if I recall correctly, in the Torah, Abraham and Yahweh were discussing the conditions of Sodom and Gomorrah. And as they were discussing the conditions, Yahweh was engaged in this conversation, and they ratcheted down how many people would have to be righteous in Sodom and Gomorrah to save the daggone place. And, you know, it finally, I think, got down to one. You know, if there's one person there, you know, I'll spare them. And so Yahweh went down, sent two messengers down to Sodom. He himself didn't go down, but he sent two of his messengers down there. And the place was pretty pathetic. And he managed to save four people, albeit one very temporarily, Lot, his wife, his daughters, from Sodom and Gomorrah. And they were not Sodomites, because they were related, actually, to Abraham, who was his nephew. So they were not Sodomites. He saved those four individuals. What did he do to Sodom?
Pretty sure he destroyed it.
Rained down fire and brimstone. As a matter of fact, at what is left of Sodom along the Dead Sea, not too far from where we found the Qumran Dead Sea Scrolls, in fact, almost directly across from it, you will find residue of the brimstone. It's sulfur based. You can put a match to it, and it burns at unbelievable temperatures, high temperatures. I've actually seen samples of it burn. It's amazing. Sodom and the Sodomites were completely destroyed. So there are exactly, let's count them, zero Sodomites.
Well, then who are we going to fight? Yeah.
With Jesus' words, it was quoting from Paul.
It was it was a very frustrating hour of radio for me. But now I'm here, and things are better.
Okay. Well, I want to speak a little bit this morning about... I told you so. I don't try to gloat very often. I'm going to gloat this morning, albeit briefly. When the Rolling Stone story came out on the alleged rape at the University of Virginia, the day that it came out, I read it. And I was a paragraph into it, and I knew that it was a fraud. I have been trained now to recognize frauds. When you devote 10,000 hours to studying the creation of Islam and what is known of Muhammad, man, you can spot a fraud a mile away. When you then devote a similar amount of time to studying Paul and demonstrating based upon his testimony that he was a fraud, you really hone your skills on fraud detection. And when it came to reading this article, and having, you know, occupational hazard of doing this program, I read a lot of news articles. You know, I share them in the first hour of this program, 5 days a week. I read a lot of news articles. And when we're sharing the news articles, I'm always trying to point out what part of the article is inaccurate. And we're constantly talking about the death of journalism and that journalism has been destroyed because facts and evidence cannot be processed rationally by those poisoned by political correctness, that political correctness has set a new code, a new standard, a new set of right and wrong, and as part of it, the practitioners of political correctness, and that would be almost everyone in the media without exception, are incapable of applying good judgment. And so, as I read that article, just in the first paragraph, I realized that it was a hack job, that it was a fraud. And then as I continued to read through it, and I saw how they were going back from historic events to this Jackie's story and trying to interweave this whole story together and to try to collectively bury universities and specifically fraternities, and how it was written that even her male friends were scoundrels. It was obvious. Every word of the article was absolutely obvious as a fraud. Now, I didn't have to do any research. I could just read the words as they were written and knew for a fact that it was a fraud. And I came on this program the morning after that article appeared, and I told you, it's a fraud. Did not happen this way. Absolutely, assuredly, and I went through everybody's motivation that was in the article and what they would have done under those circumstances, had those circumstances actually taken place the way that Jackie alleged that they did, what their response would be. And I demonstrated why it was absolutely, unequivocally a fraud. And then we had about a month later, after Teresa Sullivan, the president of UBA, had a conniption fit and banned all fraternities for several months without justification and had a conniption fit herself, that we then had the opportunity to convey that Rolling Stone retracted the article and said that the story was untrue, that the factual basis of the story was inaccurate, and they retracted the article. Well, now a couple of graduate students at the Columbia School of Journalism, as if there still was such a thing in America, have reviewed that story, and they say, no, that there were no journalistic standards that were followed as it relates to the story. And the Charlottesville Police Department has investigated thoroughly the allegations, and they came up with nothing. And as it turns out, the two young men that this girl said that she met at the aquatic park never went to the aquatic park, ever. and that the person that she identified by name as the primary attacker wasn't even a member of that fraternity. In fact, there was no one by that name at the university, and the only person who was close to that name was an entirely different fraternity house, nowhere close to the one where the accusation had been made. And that the two guys that allegedly told her, you can't go to the police, you can't report this, because if you report this, then they'll ban us from fraternities, which was nonsense, said that did never occurred. So, it's an absolute fraud. And it was an obvious fraud. And I was able to tell it was a fraud, and Rolling Stone's editorial staff was unable to tell it was a fraud, and most readers of the article were unable to tell it was a fraud, because they have been indoctrinated in political correctness. It's become the national religion of our media, of politics. And as such, people are incapable of executing good judgment. They can't differentiate between right and wrong, truth and lies. Now, that's a horrible situation to be in. And it tells us why Americans are so susceptible to the kind of lies that George Bush used to justify the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, which at the time I said is brain dead. This is suicidal. This is unbelievably counterproductive. There is no chance that the invasion of Iraq or of Afghanistan can yield a positive result, and there's 100% likelihood that we will leave both places worse than we found them after we spill lots of blood and coin. And it was obvious. All you had to do is examine the evidence and execute logic. But yet Americans were fooled. When the abominator opens his mouth and says anything, whether it be about the economy, about Islam, about extremism, everything the man says is a lie. And yet the vast preponderance of Americans are rendered incapable of recognizing that because of their belief system, which is now socialist, secular, humanism. They can, even if they were to take the time to read an article on it, they could not process the information in the article so as to tell right from wrong. It's the reason why debates are a waste of time in America. They're nothing but stylistic demonstrations, not factual comparisons. We'll be back. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Let's cover a little bit more of this story from the Columbia School of Journalism. And I want to cover it because of an issue that is near and dear to me. And I think it's really important that listeners to this program, those who value evidence and reason, those who evaluate the claims that others make, particularly in the media, have some insight with regard to slander. And so I want to get into this story a little bit more because it's important that you know why media sources are very seldom successfully sued for slander, even though their story is untrue. So, and the reason I want to do this is because we have created in America a trial by media, where the media has so much bigger platform that the media will crucify anyone who steps outside of the guidelines of their religious morals. And the person who is being assassinated via slander has no recourse. And it's important that you know why that is the case. So here's the story. New York, Reuters. The University of Virginia fraternity at the center of the Rolling Stones article, A Rape on Campus, said on Monday that it planned to sue the magazine for what it called reckless reporting that has hurt its reputation. The Phi Kappa Psi announcement came the day after a team from the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism concluded that in a report that the magazine had failed to follow basic journalistic standards. And by the way, I don't think there are any more standards. I think that a standard of discerning right and wrong, validity of a source, and the value of a conclusion, I think that's long since been changed by political correctness, which is, again, dominant not just in the media, but in academia. So in the school of journalism, you would have a double dose of political correctness. So the story is the 9,000-word story described how a student defined, identified by her real first name, Jackie, said that she endured a gang rape at that fraternity in 2012. The allegations sent shockwaves through the campus about 70 miles from Richmond, Virginia's capital. After the article was published in November, students demonstrated on campus and in front of the fraternity house, which was vandalized. You know, I went back and I opened the pictures of the nincompoops that have been also indoctrinated with political correctness, holding their signs and condemning the fraternity for something it did not do, and shouting slogans against the fraternity for something that did not happen. And you look at this and you say, okay, where are you with your apologies? Where are you, those who vandalized the fraternity? Where are you, those who demeaned those people, who harassed them? Where's your apology? Nah, see, it doesn't work that way. Not with political correctness. Now, the people who did all that think that they were justified in doing it, even though every aspect of that story was a lie. No, they feel like they were justified for acting on a lie. Why? Because it fits their view. Clearly, our fraternity's members have been defamed, but more importantly, we fear that this entire episode may prompt the victims to remain in the shadows, fearful to confront attackers. Skip Pony, the president of fraternity in Charlottesville, Virginia, said in a statement. Now, I want to tell you, the fraternity doesn't give a rat's patootie about future victims. They're saying that because they, too, want to play to the media, which is politically correct. But that is a fact, that Rolling Stones, the writer of that story, did a tremendous disservice to the women who are actually raped because of the way it handled this story. And the writer of that story knew precisely that she was fabricating the story to condemn men, and particularly young men, and particularly young men from Greek fraternity systems. She knew what she was doing. She was doing it deliberately. And the consequence, now that she has been proven to be a fraud, are egregious for former and future victims of rape. The fraternity chapter spokesman, Brian Ellis, said he did not know what would be in the lawsuit or when the fraternity's lawyers would file it. Well, the problem is that you can't win, and we will explore why they can't win, even though everything in that story was a fraud. Even though they were defamed, they cannot prevail, and we will discuss that in a moment. The fraternity said that the images of its house continue to be used in news organizations as a symbol of campus sexual assault. Boy, is that the truth. Once the media is a proponent of a story, they never let it go, even when it is proven to be false. We find that all the time now in Islamic terrorist groups being identified and associated with Al-Qaeda. But it's not true. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before we continue on the UVA story, but on a similar topic, we have Jason calling in from, used to be Toronto, and I think he lives now in Hamilton, Canada. And before we hear Jason's take on false accusations, I just want to share something I was sharing with Scott during the break, and that was that Jason is a person who has called this program in the past. He is articulate, but in particular, he's well-informed, likes evidence and reason. And one of the things that we were noting is that, without exception, one of the common denominator amongst those that we know that have chosen to be part of Yahweh's covenant family is that we all have an affinity for evidence and reason. So it is a it's as if Yahweh said, you know, what I think we need to do here, if we're going to have a good time as a family for all eternity, is that we ought to have something in common. And maybe the thing that we all have in common is a desire to know the truth and to use evidence and reason to assess it. Now, I hope that I haven't overhyped you, my friend, and I certainly don't want to infer that I am universally rational. But welcome to the program, Jason. Good to have you back.
Yeah, thanks. No, I highly value evidence and reason. Yeah, evaluating.
That's why I think. That's why I think so many
using those things is a really a beneficial way to go about it.
That's why I think so many, a preponderance of those that I know who have become part of Yahweh's covenant family have formerly been agnostics. And as agnostics, they were open-minded and curious and very much prioritized evidence
and, rightfully,
and were willing to execute
skeptical.
Good judgment about it. Yeah.
Yeah, and rightfully skeptical.
Yeah, rightfully skeptical, but would go where the evidence leads. That was which was interesting about the last comment in this story, is that the media, even when confronted with the truth, won't let go of the lie if they were part of promoting it. You know, the Benghazi raids based upon the film, having the Islamic State be linked to Al-Qaeda. When the evidence demonstrates that that's untrue, they won't let go of the lie. And that's one of the things for those who value evidence and reason, is that when evidence demonstrates that something that we've held to be true cannot be true, we'll let it go.
Yeah, it just seems to be, a lot more productive. You might always not get the answer you want, but, if you're not looking for the truth, if you don't value it, then you're going to be led down these different paths. I wanted to comment on how Yahweh instructed Israel to deal with false witnesses.
Please.
And how, if that was implemented in the U.S., what kind of an impact that would have, how beneficial that would be, all the nuisance lawsuits, all of the... to have somebody say, okay, if you're going to accuse this person of this particular crime,
right?
If you're proven false, that punishment is going to be applied to you,
and it should be.
And it's just so it's so unburdensome on the society, and all of the responsibility on the accuser, and really, it's just so.
Yeah. If you accuse somebody falsely of raping you. And it can be demonstrated that what you claimed was absolutely untrue about that individual, then the person making the accusation should suffer the penalty of jail time that would have been applied to the rapist had they actually committed the crime. And that's Yahweh's approach to it.
Yeah, exactly. It would just put everybody in check and
right.
Because the same happens with lawsuits too, right?
Mm-hmm.
A person, makes a claim or whatever, and it just might put people in their place if they were to suffer a consequence for losing. You know, someone can drag somebody through court at their own expense. They call it lawfare now. And it's being used widely with the Islamic influences, attacking media people that do want to speak out about Islam or speak truthfully about.
Because they're extraordinarily well-funded because of OPEC. And the individual who is willing to speak out against them does not have the resources to defend themselves in a lawsuit, and so they get people to capitulate.
Yeah, I just think what an impact it would have had had it been applied in the United States.
You know, it's interesting.
I always
take
the news stories like that and think about how would that have been handled,
Right.
In Israel, according to instructions. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, and in this particular case, both Jackie and the writer of the story, another woman, and the woman that is the head of Rolling Stone, in Yahweh's world of fairness, because of the damage they inflicted based upon their false testimony to others, all three of them would be incarcerated. And, you know, you'd think twice about demeaning other people's character in this way and falsely accusing them if you actually suffered the consequence. And, you know, it should be in society that rather than having the fraternity have to bring action, which the fraternity has no chance whatsoever of prevailing, and we'll talk about that in a moment, it should be the state. I mean, that was the whole idea within Yisrael, with the Yahweh's Torah teaching, was to have the community be responsible to police false witness. And yeah. Jason, you know, if you look down through Yahweh's seven instructions to us after the three broad statements about himself and the covenant, he has seven instructions. The first is the most important, which is the Shabbat, right? The second is to highly value your heavenly father and spiritual mother. The third is about adultery, because Yahweh doesn't want us to cheat on the covenant. But the next one is don't bear false witness.
Yeah, and it's a big one.
It's a big one. And of course, in Islam, it's the opposite.
It becomes a very oppressive thing on everyone.
Right. In Islam, in the Quran, Allah acknowledges twice in the Quran that he's a liar. And Muhammad acknowledges twice in the Quran that he's a liar, bearing false witness. And Muhammad, throughout the Hadith, encourages Muslims to bear false witness so that they can ambush unsuspecting prey, non-Muslims.
Yeah.
And Yahweh says, no. And he says of himself that everything I've said is true. And then he says that we ought not bear false witness. Then he actually, in Devarim 13 and 18, Deuteronomy 13 and 18, provides us with a comprehensive test to determine if somebody's speaking the truth.
Yep. Yeah, contradicting,
contradicting what Yah has said is proof that, like Paul did, it's proof that he is not speaking for Yahweh. It's a two standard on prophecy. One is your statements have to include, if you're speaking for Yahweh, your statements have to include prophecy as a test, and your prophecies have to come true 100% of the time.
Yep.
Paul, of course, failed on both of those. Well, he had one prophecy, he just got it wrong. Yahweh has some very clear criteria.
Right.
He would have been. Yeah, would have been Paul, killed. He should have been killed.
Paul would have been stoned, and his legacy would never have existed.
Right. Exactly.
I believe too the consequence for rape was stoning.
Yeah, I mean, rape is a heinous crime. I think that the single worst crime that I'm aware of is rape of a child, pedophilia. I think that is the single worst thing a human being can do. But, murder, rape, high on the list. Although Yahweh, I think, based upon the third statement that he etched in stone, would establish one human tendency as more heinous, more damaging than rape, than pedophilia, than murder, than robbery. And that's bearing false witness regarding who he is and what he's offering that leads people astray. Because it has such a negative effect on so many people who are susceptible to believing the false witness.
Oh, well, thanks for having me on, Yada. I got to get back to
you. Okay, and if you find any sodomites out there, will you take care of them for me?
I'm sorry?
If you find me something, I don't know if you heard the beginning, but Scott was talking about a former host that was out there battling the sodomites.
So, well,
there are no sodomites in today's world, but I was just kidding, saying if you find any sodomites out there, take care of them for me.
Okay, I'll do that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jason. By the way, it's interesting on the sodomites. We only know, I think, about four or five things about Sodom and Gomorrah. But of the sodomites. First, we know where they live. They lived right around the Dead Sea, essentially across from where the Qumran scrolls were found, so within a few miles of that area along the shores of the Dead Sea. We know the location. We know the timing that the community existed, which would have been right around 2000 BCE, because that's when Yah was having the conversations with Abraham about them. So right around 1970-ish BCE, the community was thriving. We know that Yahweh destroyed them. So we can find brimstone, because he told us how he destroyed them there. We also know that they had, and we only know, unless I'm missing something, three characteristics about the Sodomites. First, they were prone to rage. Second, they were prone to violence. And third, they were prone to sexual perversion, particularly desiring to rape unsuspecting, just rape others in a bisexual manner, because their initial thriving was somewhat homosexual, and they were offered a heterosexual alternative. Although, to be fair, spirits, the spiritual messengers that that came to Sodom, would not have a sex. So there is really no affinity for that. But those are the three characteristics. And so in America, there's probably 2-3% of men who are bisexual, about 1% who are homosexual. Very few homosexuals are prone to rage, and very few are prone to violence. So I don't even know where you would find symbolically a sodomite. So here is the issue. To prevail in a defamation suit, the fraternity, this is according to the Reuters article or someone speaking. Now, this is actually Rebecca Touchet, a Georgetown University law professor. She said to prevail in a defamation lawsuit, the fraternity would need to first show that the accusations in the story, were false. No, it doesn't have to show that. The magazine's already acknowledged that they are false. More than that, there have been, the police have investigated the story. They said they are false. The university has investigated the story. They have said they're false. And it's obvious to anyone reading the story that they're false. So they actually do not have to demonstrate that the accusations against it in the story are false. They've already been demonstrated. And that it suffered damages as a result. They don't have to demonstrate that either, because they have absolute proof. With all of the protests against it, first of all, the fraternity was suspended by the university. That's a damage. And also, they were vandalized as a result of the story, and they had protests accusing them, defaming them. And their image now of that fraternity house is used on television and the media as the poster child, literally, for sexual assault on campus, even though they aren't guilty of the crime they were accused of. So they've got that already covered and in spades. And then they have to show damages such as fewer applications or restricted donations from alumni. Actually, they don't have to show that they had fewer donations from alumni. That is irrelevant to their burden of proof. Then it would need to show that Rolling Stone was negligent in its reporting. That is true. That means that they have to show that Rolling Stone should have known and could have known the truth and just disregarded it, was negligent. So it's not just that the story is untrue, but you have to show that the entity providing the story was negligent in their reporting. So it's not just untrue, but that it's obvious that it was untrue and that they knew that it was untrue at the time. Or actually, knowing that it's untrue would be fraud, and that is a requirement as a public entity. But negligent means that they just did nothing. I mean, that the information was available to them to follow up. They could have followed up. They would have found that had they done an investigation, that it would have disproven their story, but they chose not to do it. So negligent in that regard. then if the court finds that the fraternity was a public figure, then it would have to prove that the magazine was reckless and acted with malice. So that's the issue. And by the way, being a public figure, obviously a politician is a public figure. So a politician has to prove that the entity writing the story, you have to get into the mindset of the entity writing the story to say they did so with deliberate malice and that they were reckless, that the truth was so obvious, that what they were saying was so obviously wrong, the truth was so available and so pervasive, that there's no way anybody in their right mind could come to the conclusion they came to, that no reasonable person under any circumstances could come to that conclusion. And that beyond that, you have to get into their mindset and say, well, they operated with malice, that their intent was to maliciously defame, to slander the fraternity, that they had no pretense whatsoever of simply reporting a story, that their intent was to harm, and to harm maliciously. Now, you know how hard it is to prove somebody's mindset? It's essentially impossible. Now, as a public figure, I was once a public figure because I ran a public company. But any time that you are doing, like this show, I am addressing the public. So as it relates to this show, I'm a private individual. I'm a public figure based upon what I show on, do on this show. In terms of the books that I've written, even though I charge nothing for them, and even though I simply, and I don't promote them in any way, the very fact that they're available for the world to read publicly would mean that as the author of those books, even though I wrote them anonymously, it might be construed that I'm a public figure. As a public figure, you have no rights. You know, Business Week, years ago, slandered me. And their 14-page article, nothing they said was factually accurate. There were 77 outright lies in their article. And it was reckless. And it was done with malice. But every attorney that looked at the case said, you have no chance to win because you will be deemed a public figure.